Eat Drink Indiana Radio is brought to you by Eskenazi Health, one of Central Indiana's leading providers of health care. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndy.com, where Central Indiana turns to learn about food from farm to fork and drink from grains to glass.
Welcome to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD to the Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. Well, we are all about local here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio this week, but maybe even more so than usual, because we're talking Dig In, A Taste of Indiana, with the festival's executive director, Tom England. So we're looking forward to eating local this Sunday at the fest, which takes place in White River State Park. And we're also drinking local this week as we stop in at Easley Winery in downtown Indianapolis to talk wine with Mark and Meredith Easley and to hear about the history of the winery, the challenges of getting their wines onto store shelves and into restaurants, and then what actually happens when you stop in for a tasting, or if you come by on a Saturday afternoon for Easley's popular Groovin' in the Garden. So stay with us here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. So this is a big weekend when it comes to local food in Indianapolis. More than 40 chefs, along with food artisans, breweries, and wineries from around the state, will be participating in Dig In, A Taste of Indiana in White River Park this Sunday. The festival's executive director, Tom England, fills us in on how the festival came about and how it developed into the local food extravaganza that it is now.
A little history on Dig In, you know, how it happened and what the Taste of Indiana is and that sort of thing.
Dig In was started when Alice Waters was in town to do a little speaking engagement at Indianapolis Museum of Art. I was invited to have lunch with her along with Regina Mihalik and Neil Brown. It's funny because the three of us were sitting in the lobby kind of waiting because we were thinking, you know, it's some huge dinner, donor event or whatever, and all of a sudden, Alice Waters just walks up by herself and says, oh, yeah, let's go have lunch. And so literally the four of us just sat down and had lunch and for over a two-hour period talked about what's going on in Indiana, what's going on in Indianapolis. And she said, you know, you just need to do this and celebrate Indiana food in some way. And so Neil and I kind of looked at each other and said, okay, let's do it. That night we met with person from Department of Ag and somebody else from Department of Tourism for the state, and you know, we just kind of said, you know, we can do this, and so it all kind of evolved from that.
And what year was that?
2007, I believe it was. So yeah, we went through almost a 2-year planning stages and funds development and everything before we did the first festival. So this will be our sixth festival.
How has it grown over the years? We talked a little bit earlier about this physical space in Dig In here in the park and how it's spread out, but it has grown a lot, right?
Yeah, it's grown a lot. So the first year we had to really search to find 24 different restaurants in the state who really promoted Indiana food. Now this year we vetted 48. So we actually check every restaurant now to make sure that they're actually using local food, not just saying they're using local food. We go and look at their menus. We look at their promotion to see that they're actually promoting Indiana food too. So yeah, I mean, I think we have some of the best restaurants around who are really, really concerned about where their food comes from.
So twice as many as you had when you started. Now, that is a big jump. You know, is the number of restaurants that are using and promoting local food, has that grown over the years?
Yeah, that's the biggest thing is that, you know, I think it's become the norm for independent restaurants to use local food, where before people didn't even understand how to use local food. And so, you know, we've set up a lot of infrastructure. Piazza Produce has really jumped on board and goes out and picks up stuff from small farms and brings it back and distributes it throughout the state. So, you know, people like that helping out the industry to make sure that we're using foods that people want to eat.
You know, and so what kind of local foods are people going to see? You know, because here we are, you know, at the the height of harvest times, you know, so we're expecting corn and tomatoes, but what else will we see?
Yeah, you know, people ask all the time, why don't you do this later when it's not as hot, or, you know, why don't you do it different times of year? We're very intentional when it is. So it's the end of the summer season and the beginning of the fall season. And so we can get fresh tomatoes and corn, but we can also get watermelons and pumpkin and stuff that's actually starting to come out from the fall stuff. And so we have a huge variety of stuff from, you know, apples, which is a fall product, tomatoes, corn, of course, all the commodity meats, the pork, the beef, lamb. Somebody's doing a roast goat this year. Rabbit, duck. Indiana Maple Leaf Duck is going to be here with their duck truck this year. I think we have 4 booths that are doing duck. A lot of people don't realize we're the number one producer of duck in the world, and we're the 48th lowest consumer in the United States of duck. And so, you know, we need to be out there telling people, hey, there's great Indiana duck, and hopefully we'll do some promotions around that as well.
That's part of the education, right? To sort of show people, you know, what is available here and then what chefs do with it.
Right. And it's not just saying, okay, this is available or this is what you can do with it. It's also saying, do you know where your food comes from, and do you know how it's grown or raised? That's a big part of our concern is, you know, people don't realize how food is raised or grown. And so we put all different types of stuff in the park so that you can taste that difference between that, you know, heirloom raised pig or the mass produced pig. And you can make your thoughts and, you know, own judgment on if it makes a difference or not.
Are there some things that you think might be, you know, surprising, you know, about Indiana food? And what's available, or, you know, what we come up with here?
Yeah, so I think the biggest thing that's surprising to me is the variety of stuff. I mean, who realizes we're growing rutabagas and turnips on a mass scale, or, you know, that type of thing. And so when we start to look at the variety of stuff that's grown and raised here, you start to realize that you can live year-round off the stuff that is here. Which I've been doing for 9 years now at home.
Yeah, that's right. So you have been living on a local diet, right?
Yeah, and actually that local circle is getting smaller and smaller. So almost everything comes from Central Indiana that I eat at home now. You know, we've got to have the little cheat thing. So I do drink coffee, but that coffee is locally roasted. But even now, I mean, I'm getting great sunflower oil and canola oil that is raised or grown, you know, just down the road here. And so even the oils I'm getting locally. The only thing I can't find locally is citrus fruit. So now I have a little lemon tree growing at home, and hopefully I have some lemons soon.
We've been talking with Tom England, Executive Director of Dig In, A Taste of Indiana, which takes place Sunday afternoon in White River State Park. For more information on the festival, go to digindiana.org. Well, if you are headed to Dig In, A Taste of Indiana on Sunday, you'll find all sorts of food, drink, and entertainment in White River State Park, all focused on local producers. I walked through the park earlier this week with Executive Director Tom England as the tents were going up and the festival grounds were beginning to take shape. We talked about what to expect and what's new this year for the popular Food Fest. So as you come into White River State Park, you know, you see the big empty spaces. What's going to fill this space here when all the people come? What will they see in all this space?
It's funny because when you walk through here now, it looks like a big space. But once we get all the fencing up and the tents up and then get 4,000 people in the park, all of a sudden it's very tight in here. So, yeah, I'm always amazed at this transition point when all this stuff starts to happen. So, you know, we'll see the gates here where people will come through. Last year we had 3,000 people come through in about 12 minutes. So hopefully we're that quick again this year.
So now you have, you know, plans in place to get all those people in and in so quickly. You know, are the logistics tough, you know, of moving people in fast? Because the early birds want to get in quick, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the logistics are insane. So there's 800 volunteers here that day between all the restaurants, but all the volunteers in the park as well. And so we're coordinating 800 volunteers with a volunteer who coordinates volunteers. So it's all kinds of logistics. So on Tuesday, all the front gate people were here doing a little training and learning how to use the iPads to check people in and all of that stuff. So, yeah, there's a lot of different trainings that go on for every little area in the park.
So Thursday, tents going up, right?
Yeah. So today, tents are going up. We'll have all of our signage start to go up on Saturday primarily. Friday is delivery day for all the tables and chairs and, you know, anything that the tent company doesn't bring, everything else comes on Friday. So we have the park actually started on Friday, and we'll start fencing it off on Friday as well.
So now, do you know where everything is going to go, where all the people are going to be, and this is here and that's there?
There's a desire, right? You can kind of see the flow of people in your mind, and you hope that it happens that day. And it may be a mud puddle that starts, and then all of a sudden it just totally changes traffic patterns and stuff. So, you know, you just kind of keep your fingers crossed and set up the tents and everything so that there's a traffic pattern. So hopefully people spread out more. We don't have a big line in one spot and empty lines in other spots. There's a whole science to it. There's literally a science to crowd logistics.
You know, and I guess I never think about that, you know, because, you know, the first year was probably a learning experience, you know, and that was the year where people, they walked in and they seemed to stop at the very first tent they found, and a line just started. So it was interesting to see how the crowd reacted that first year and how you've, you know, responded to that and changed the layout.
Yeah, we intentionally spread people out. And it wasn't necessarily the first tent that they got to that they stopped at. It was the first beer tent that they stopped at.
Of course, right?
So, of course, we spread the four alcohol places out, or the four booths of alcohol out, so that people can spread out more at that point, and then put food around it so they start at different points.
Okay, so along the canal area. So what will people see in that area? This is probably where a lot of people will come in at, right?
Yeah, so the first year, actually, this was it. This was where everybody was. We didn't have any other part of the park at that point. Luckily, we've kind of spread out and added new restaurants and everything. So it's still the main area of the park. So we'll have a big entrance area, and then also just on the other side of the entrance, on the outside of the park, it will have the pedal and park. So we had close to 300 people ride their bikes here last year. It's always a big draw for people to ride their bikes down here. So I think in the second year was the biggest one. We had 600 people ride their bikes in the second year. But yeah, the open area here will have four tents and a majority of the food in this area.
Now the round area off to the sort of left of the main area, what's going to be in that area?
Yeah, the circle area. So we'll have two more tents. We'll have 14 more restaurants in that area. We'll have a beer tent and wine tent in that area. And then just on the other side of the circle, we'll have Yelp in there. And Yelp is going to bring tables and chairs and, you know, big overstuffed beanbag type things so you can recharge yourself as well as recharge your phone at that point.
So it's starting to happen, right? So it's all the pieces are starting to come together. Kind of go over some, a little bit of the numbers.
Oh, that's interesting. So number of tents. There's six food tents. There's four beer tents, four wine tents, two VIP tents, chef's competition tent. And again, it's all spread out so that hopefully the line spread out and people flow through pretty evenly. We have 4,000 people. We cap it at 4,000 so that people can move around. If you can imagine 4,000 people times 48 restaurants, that's a lot of forks and spoons and plates. And so, yeah, you know, I think we have 14,000 plates at this point.
Right? Because, well, and you need that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that even seems low. I'm trying to do this math in my head. 48 times four. And so, yeah, 56,000.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's insane. That's insane.
That's a lot of parts.
Yes.
You know, a lot of moving pieces to put this on.
Yeah. And you know, it's a year-round planning process. A lot of people don't realize. I mean, this is basically $250,000 party for 4,000 people. The cost of admission doesn't even pay for what we have to put out for food and tents and such. So it is really a promotion for Indiana food and agriculture. And it's all for the chefs and the farmers. There's, you know, it's promoting what we do on a daily basis here in the state.
Over here is the chef competition. Is
chef
that right?
Chef competition, right. So there's nine chefs competing for the best sous chef in the city. It all really is pretty much Indianapolis for that group. So it'll be three rounds, preliminary rounds, and one final round. And you'll be able to sit on the tiered area that is behind the pump house here. It's pretty shaded in the afternoons. and very cool back here. So it sets a little bit lower, and a good place to rest and relax and watch what's going on with the chefs here.
Now, have you used this area before?
No, this is a new area for us. It's you know, it's always kind of hidden back here, mm-hmm. but if we're in the circle from the circle area, there will be a beer tent, and then Yelp, and then this area. And so we've tried to create that natural flow to this area. Most people didn't know it was here before. Yeah, we'll have under the tent three little tables with induction burners where they're going to be able to cook, a little deep fryer, pantry area. We'll actually have it displayed on screens. So there's cameras over each table so you can see what's going on at the table. And we'll have, almost like Iron Chef, we'll have the Alton Brown character doing most of the emceeing, and then the Kevin Brosh that'll be in the kitchen and giving the chefs a hard time and trying to figure out what they're doing. So it's a mystery basket competition. In the mystery basket, they'll have protein, starch, a vegetable, and they have to cook four plates of food and that the three judges will taste and then one for looking at and evaluating.
Well, that sounds fun. I think that'll be a popular addition, you know, to the festival this year. And again, a nice area to maybe get away from the hubbub a little bit and right. sit down, you know, and watch for a while.
Yeah. And that's the hope is that, you know, people will be able to relax and you know, take their time a little bit and really enjoy the park and hopefully a beautiful day.
Now, you've never had a complete washout.
We haven't had a rain event. Unfortunately, we've had 105 degree weather. On a couple of occasions, but this year it's shaping up to be, you know, nice and 85 and breezy. So,
oh no, that will be very nice, much nicer for walking around because that's one of the things that people need to know is it covers a big area. You go, do you go all the way over to the bridge area?
Halfway across the bridge this year, so we'll have 7 food trucks on the bridge, and then renewing our waterways. Big car will have their big trailer up there, so you'll be able to go up and look at some of the stuff that they're doing with renewing our waterways, which is kind of neat because it's right in the middle of White River, right over it on the bridge, so it's perfect location. Yeah,
so you have 7 food trucks, 48 chefs, you have food artisans as well, right?
Food artisans, yeah. Those are the Indiana artisans. They'll be in a separate tent. They'll be in tent 3 along with some actual artists who have created things at our last event, which is Imbibe, Indulge, and Inspire. We call it I3. And so people were grouped together as chefs, bartenders, and artists, and they were given an Indiana landmark to develop their theme around. And so one was like the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And so the people who did the Speedway, where there was a person doing art at the event, and the bartender did a beer drink. And the Abby Maris, that team is the one that won the competition. Abby did a walking taco, but on an upscale level. So it was very interesting. So those artists took those pieces home that they'd started, and they finished those. And now they're bringing them back to the festival so that you can see them and purchase them as well.
Are there some other things about the festival that people can expect? You know, what kind of food? You know, I think I've noticed that there are more vegetarian options maybe this year.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things we've done this year is, and we've always given chefs a choice of things to choose from, and that is to actually inspire them to cook something that isn't being sold a lot by the farm so that people can see how to cook those different products. So this year, instead of just having protein listed, we actually listed like corn as one of the main center of the plate ingredients that one of the restaurants had to use. And several of those center of the plate things had to be vegetable or fruit based. And so we have more vegetarian options this year for sure.
Sweet. So do we have a kind of a sweet angle here?
Yeah, you know, we have the ones that are always here, Rini's Cookies in Evansville will be back up here, and Circle City Sweets. Nicey Treats will be here with their cold goodness.
Always popular.
Yeah, and Beet Java Coffee is doing a watermelon drink this year, so that'll be a nice way to relax too and cool down.
And you have people using fruit as well, so that'll be nice.
Yeah, so that's what Cindy is doing from Circle City Sweets. She's grilling a peach and putting it on a shortbread, basically, and it looks fabulous. The peaches that they got were huge, beautiful, sweet peaches. So yeah, I'm very much looking forward to trying that again.
okay, now I know, I'm sure that you don't get to, you know, leisurely stroll around the fest and take it all in, but you've been involved in all of them. So do you have some advice for people who are going to be coming around trying to make the most of their time here at Dig In?
Yeah, so plan ahead of time, first of all. So the map is online. If you go to digindiana.org and click on festival, you can look at the map and see where everybody's at. So you can see what they're serving and see if you want to try specific things and have a little game plan of, you know, maybe getting a drink and going and having three or four different bites and then, you know, finding out what you want to do from there. So, you know, take your time. We definitely have enough food to fill you up. For sure, some of the chefs are going to run out of food. Each chef produces 3,000 pieces of food. There's 4,000 paid attendees in the park. So, you know, 48 restaurants, if you try everything, there's 7 pounds of food that you would eat.
Yeah, you do make a good point in that, you know, if you do have a particular chef that you want to get to or a particular dish you want to try, you know, hit those early, right?
Yeah, and I would actually recommend you don't go to the places that you go to all the time. Go to the places that you've never been to and try their food and hear their food philosophies. I mean, that's the greatest thing about this event is that, you know, we're bringing people in from all over the state, not just Indianapolis. And so you can try stuff from, you know, LaSalle Grill up in South Bend or Jay Ford's in Terre Haute, yeah, which I think was one of my favorite dishes last year. They always do a really good job. There's places from all over.
We've been talking Dig In, A Taste of Indiana with Executive Director Tom England. For more details on the fest and to plan your visit, go to digindiana.org. Eat, Drink Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Eskenazi Health, providing care to nearly 1 million outpatient visitors each year with the mission to advocate, care, teach, and serve at its hospital and inpatient facility and 11 community health centers located throughout Indianapolis. EskenaziHealth.edu. Well, we've been talking Dig In this week here on Eat, Drink Indiana Radio, but with such a big local food and drink focus in Indianapolis this weekend, I decided to stop in at Easley Winery. Now, the winery has been a downtown fixture since the 70s, but owners Mark and Meredith Easley feel like it's just now hitting its winemaking stride. A tour through the winery lets visitors in on just how much is going on at 205 North College Avenue.
So in 72, they began looking in Indiana for a vineyard site. They said, okay, it's legal now, let's make the plunge. But of course, they had to plant a vineyard and wait 3 years to get a grape. So
because nobody was doing this,
nobody
right?
was doing it. It wasn't legal. If they were doing it, they were bootlegging. So they might have been doing it as a hobby or something. But families like Banholzers up around Gary and Michigan City, Oliver's down at Bloomington, the Mancusos down at Madison, Indiana, Mom and Dad, and then Ben and Lee Sparks down in Brown County. So those families then started growing grapes and started all started wineries. So the winery started in the 70s. We were an estate winery. We planted our vineyard down in Crawford County, Indiana, by the little town of Leavenworth. Got as high as 37 acres of grapes in that 30 years. And the parents had the idea of fine wine. They were an estate winery. They were growing grapes and making their wine, and that's what they wanted to do. And when my father passed away in the 90s, had a big family meeting. Do we continue the business or not? Unfortunately, I met somebody called Meredith, my lovely wife here. And so she got involved. Equally as crazy, yes. Enthusiastic and very marketing focused. So a great, great pair. And to that end, we decided to stay in the wine business. We spent 3 years traveling the world looking at business models for wineries, restaurants, wedding halls, wholesaling versus not wholesaling. And we eventually established on a business model we wanted. The big problem was our facility was not set up right. We didn't have the right equipment. We had a lot of old dairy equipment and used equipment the parents had picked up over the years.
Now, is that this facility
this
right
facility,
here?
Yes. This is the former Furtick Ice Cream Factory. It made soft serve ice cream for Burger Chef and Jeff and Dairy Queen. And it was owned by the Furtick family. They were bought out by the Borden Company for the accounts. They did not want the facility. And so we bought this in 1974. So we consider our start date as June 1st, 1974, when they purchased the building. But actually, the vineyard started back in 71 down in Crawford County. So the facility obviously we'd like to have a little bit different. It's got a great old world charm, but from a modern manufacturing standpoint, we'd like to have something obviously a little fancier. But mother and father sold their home in 1976, and we moved here as a family in the building. So we lived upstairs, worked downstairs, and it was a true labor of love. And like you say, when they moved here, downtown closed up and left. No Circle Center Mall. Lockerbie Square was just starting with the early pioneers there as far as renovations. And, of course, everybody went to the suburbs. So we've watched the transformation of people living downtown, retail coming back downtown. It's been amazing.
It must be gratifying.
It's exciting, and we certainly see it in the retail area. Now, our business model has changed quite a bit in that we're more of a focused on wholesale, in that we sell in a five-state region, Indiana and the surrounding states. Our real growth has happened out in the Myers and the Walmarts and the Marshes and the Krogers.
But that's a bit of a difference from some, you know, in the wine business who are a little dismissive of wine in the grocery stores.
Yes, it could be. They want their own wine shop and someone there. But to us, that drives people away from wine. I'd say 180 degrees opposite what we are. We want you to drink what you like. It doesn't matter price. It doesn't matter medals or competitions. It doesn't matter personal recommendations from a chef or a wine guru. It's if you like it and it happens to be $8.99, lucky you, you're not going to spend a lot of money on wine, and you're going to be pretty happy drinking wine.
And when you can get it at the grocery store, I mean, I don't know about a lot of other people, but I am always at the grocery store, you know, so it's very handy for me. I've always thought to pick up wine at the grocery store when I'm buying the food and the meals, and I'm thinking about, you know, what I might enjoy.
And if you're buying fresh, you probably are there at least 2 to 3 times a week. Packaged food lasts weeks. If you're buying fresh, it does, you know, you have to go at least twice a week, if not 3 times a week, to get your produce and vegetables and so forth. So, yeah, that's where people are. That's where we want to be. That's where we see our synergies is in the grocery environment. When my mom and dad had it, this was the winery. This is the fermentation room. We had a great press right here. All the wine was made in this one room. And then as we've grown now, we're into 5 buildings here on a little campus. And basically have blessed this winery as our estate winery program. That is the small lot batches that we're doing are made in this building, and then our larger batches that we do for the grocery store and the wholesale environment are done in the back building. But basically the winery is laid out in the order that a grape goes through the facility. That is, we start out at the crusher, go through crushing, pressing. We come back in through fermentation, come through here. We talk about clarification and barrel aging. Then the tour typically winds up back at the bottling line. We show them how we put it in the bottle. And what we're trying to do there is show consumers and or wine potential wine drinkers how wine is grown. It's not made. It's not Kool-Aid or Gatorade where you're taking water and flavor and mixing it. But it's a living organism that came in from a farm out on the crush pad. And then we add yeast. The yeast eat the sugar, make the alcohol, the carbon dioxide, and the heat, and then explain to them why some wines are red, some are white. We can make white wines from red grapes. People don't understand the color comes from the skins. And then we get into talking about alcohol content, direct relation to the amount of sugar in the original grapes. So we talk alcohol. We talk color, which is the white Zinfandel versus red Zinfandel. And then we also talk about flavors, which would be oak barrels, whether a wine gets oaked or not, depends on the flavor we're trying to achieve. Sweetness level, huge for Americans who grew up on Coca-Cola and Captain Crunch. We typically drink sweeter wines when we're younger, coming out of Captain Crunch phase, and we drift toward drier wines. But what's interesting, as we get older, a lot of folks drift back to sweeter wines.
Now, people say a lot, you know, that Hoosiers have a sweet palate, or they say people in the South have a sweet palate. Do you find that is typically true?
Yes. People talk dry, drink sweet. But for some reason, there's a stigma with sweet that it's not quality. And that is something that's left over from the 60s and 70s when the Gallows and the Sutter Homes would take damaged wine, oxidized wine, throw sugar in it, and sell it at a reduced price. You can make a very, very high quality sweet wine from the vineyard. That is, we do vineyard practices to make sure that wine has enough acid to counterbalance the sweet, so it's not syrupy. You want a balanced wine. And you can build that literally from the vineyard and bring it through the winemaking process and make a world-class sweet wine. that in this day and age, we're just fighting the stigma of folks from the 60s and 70s and their opinions. Whether we do malolactic fermentations, which is a process, we change malic acid to lactic acid, which is a mellowing effect, how much tannin is in the wine, the blending of the wines, all of that is kind of an artist with a palate. And that is, the winemaker uses those particular techniques in the cellar to make a particular style or taste of wine. So, and our goal here at the winery is to educate people on that, tell them how that is, or why that is, and how we do it, so they find wines they like. What you'll find as an industry, we make certain wines dry and make certain wines sweet. So if you like sweet wines, don't go looking for Cabernets or Pinot Noirs. But if you like dry wines, don't go looking for Rieslings or Reggae Reds.
No, I say if you're coming to the winery on a Saturday, you're here for the great party that we throw. Okay. I mean, we give you a great time when you're here, and we acquaint you with the wines that we make. And if you do notice that there are tanks and barrels, you may connect that it was made here. But otherwise, we're just here to show you a really great time.
Drink wine. I'll be unabashed and say, I want to get you out of the beer aisle. I want to get you out of the spirits aisle and get you into the wine aisle. But the intimidation factor is there.
Is it still there after all this time? Are we still intimidated by wine?
I would say yes, because you're walking into a department in a grocery store that has literally 400 different labels, that has a price point from $3.99 to $100. There's so much choice there, that part of it is intimidating. As Americans, you pay more, you get more. We have to debunk that in wine. Paying more doesn't mean you'll like the wine anymore. A $40 bottle of wine is not going to taste better than a $10 bottle of wine unless you know that about the grapes or how it was made. So price cannot be equated to quality or preference, and so that is an educational part. The other thing that we have to kind of watch is the competitions, the gold medals. While we love that from a marketing standpoint, because there are folks that buy gold medal wines, you have to understand you would have to have the same tastes and likes as the four to five judges who gave that a gold wine. And typically those are folks that drink wine two or three times a week. So if you're a brand new wine drinker that doesn't drink wine at all, I doubt you're going to like really dry, tannic, Cabernet, oak-aged wines from Napa Valley.
Even if it won awards.
Even if it won awards, yeah. It could be $100 a bottle and have six gold medals on it, and you're going to go, this is sour, this is bitter, this tannin is drying out my mouth, it's puckery. You know, all kinds of adjectives and facial expressions come with that. But there is a crowd that loves that and gives it gold medals, but you have to understand there's also a crowd that likes Easley's Reggae Red or Oliver Soft Red. They're in the top 10.
I was going to best selling.
Right. And so you have to say people vote with their dollar.
People need to start someplace. So they pick the wine that won, because, hey, somebody who knows more about wine picked it. I can start there.
Right. With that, like you said, you have to start somewhere. They're like, okay, I'm not going to spend more than $10, $20. They don't say, okay, I'm not going to spend below $4.99. You know, it's...
And back to that Kroger or Meijer section, how pretty is the label? That's the other thing that comes up a lot.
I certainly have, you know, chosen wines based on an eye-catching label.
Yes. Or you eliminate based on a label you don't like.
So, no, you're absolutely right. Yeah, I do the same thing.
So
that's not necessarily a terrible thing.
But it isn't reflective of what you're going to have in your glass of dinner.
No, it isn't. That's
it
exactly
is
right.
Of the house style. So, like with the Reggae, it's a party in a bottle. We want it to say party in the bottle, whereas we want the Traminette to say, okay, guess what? Sit down, enjoy this, sip it, you know, enjoy it. Whereas, you know, the Sweet Tulip, it's meant to be this happy-go-lucky, beautiful, beautiful wine. So each label does convey how we built the wine, but that's the philosophy of the winery, and that's where you do get a much better reflection in the bottle based on the label with regional or local wines, because when you get to that corporate level, it's a corporate design decision. It hasn't been built by the same people from the vineyard to the glass with a philosophy and a theory and a concept that they wanted the entire experience to convey.
We've been talking with Mark and Meredith Easley of Easley Winery in downtown Indianapolis. Stay with us for more on local wine here on WFYI and WFYI.org. Well, we talk a lot about local food and drink here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, but no one ever said that being a local producer is easy. In fact, it can sometimes be a real challenge. I talked with local winery owners Mark and Meredith Easley recently about the challenges facing local winemakers in getting their products onto store shelves,
and onto local wine lists.
You now have three big grocery chains dominating Indianapolis, and that means there's three buyers, one in Cincinnati, one in Grand Rapids, and one in Fishers, that really decides the access for all these thousands of wineries that want access to their shelves.
Oh, that's interesting. I never really thought about that.
Consumer has to work harder. Yeah. Yep.
And the winery has to work harder because there are so many people that want that. And with the big corporations buying wineries, companies like Constellation that own 65 different wineries from around the world, they're going to have a little more muscle when they walk in to say, we want this shelf space versus a winery from Brown County or Marion County or someplace in Indiana. So that part is real, and it's an ongoing battle. It's hard to keep regional sections in grocery stores. We've actually heard rumors that large corporations have said, hey, why don't you get rid of those regional sections? You don't need those because we offer everything from $2.99 to $100 a bottle, and we could do it across the country on your footprint, and you wouldn't have to figure out different shelf sets.
Right, which is bad for the local consumer who wants to, you know, support local businesses, right?
Right. No, and that is a big problem, and I think some chains are very aware of that. I mean, if you look at Meijer, the size of the regional wine section there, they've embraced regionality, where you look in some other chains, the regional wine section is either non-existent or extremely small.
Well, it's a challenge, and that's what I spend a lot of my time on, is trying to convince those buyers, you know, like with the Traminette, if you're saying you believe in local, here's a great opportunity, you know, but go ahead and offer it. The consumer has to ask.
Hey, we want this. You know, yeah. If you are all about fresh local foods and wines, you've got to carry them.
Now, is there a challenge with the wines, you know, because we've seen a lot of people who, you know, they talk about drinking local and they're a big support of craft beer. Has it been a challenge getting that same sort of drink local emphasis when it comes to wine?
A huge challenge, and particularly the wine industry has an even bigger challenge. We lost our ability to direct sell to retailers about, 8 years ago, 9 years ago with the Indiana General Assembly. Breweries locally can still sell directly to a Marsh, a Meijer, or Kroger, whereas wineries by law have to sell through a wholesaler. And so the three-tier system has been reestablished. Fortunately, through the 70s, 80s, and 90s, we're able to sell directly to Marsh. We would go up and actually stock our wine and be a direct advocate for our product. Now we have to go through a middleman and hope that everybody in the chain there is an advocate for local and local wines. So, it allows larger, more established wineries like Easley, Oliver, Huber, good access. We have great partners. We're big. We've been around a lot of years. We've proven our track record. But a new startup, a new local winery coming in that doesn't have that, they're going to have trouble for market access, and I don't have an answer to that. The good news is the Indiana legislature this year went back and at least gave us the right to direct ship up to 5,000 cases a year. So a winery in Brown County or Madison County or wherever now has the ability to at least ship to a customer again. And so I think
without major barriers.
So yeah. I think that'll let small wineries get their feed under them and establish their reputations, establish their protocols for grape growing and winemaking, and then be able to prove to a wholesaler that take them on. And that's hard, really hard. I don't envy a winery starting today from that standpoint, that they really have to fight just to get in the market. And so, you know, they really have to hang their hat on wine quality, their packaging, their pricing, that is the value of the value of the wine versus the price of the bottle and all that. It's hard. When folks come to us, a lot of folks will come and say, hey, we're thinking about this. I discourage them and you know, really point out that this is going to be hard, and it's going to be a fight because of the decks kind of stacked against you with this three-tier system model that we have right now. So, whereas the majority of your Indiana wineries are growing at least a percentage of their grapes locally. And so to that end, you can't get any more local than local wine. But you don't find the embrace in the marketplace of let me put it this way. You can't go to Mass Avenue and find local wine on wine lists the way you can find local beer.
Yeah, is it because of the perception of quality, you know, or the question of whether Indiana wines, you know, can compete? I mean, we know they can because they win awards, right? But is there a perception there that you have to fight against?
If you have the answer to that, our industry would love, because you have Oliver Winery at Bloomington with the number one, number two, and number four wine in the state sold in grocery stores, and you don't find it on any local restaurant. You find Easley, Huber, Chateau Thomas, Buck Creek Winery, all winning gold medals around the country, not just Indiana competitions, but California, Oregon.
Beating wines that are on wine lists within the Mile Square, that if they had the Indiana equivalency, it would be priced similarly and might actually be more exciting on the list.
And, you know, we make 21 different wines. So, we sell a lot of sweet reggae wine because that's what sells and keeps the lights on. But we also make some great Cabernets, some great Chambersins, some great Traminettes that would be great food pairing wines.
2013 Cabernet took a gold medal at the Monterey Wine Competition in California, and it's priced about the same as what you'd see as a lot of the, like, Louis Martini from Gallo on a wine list.
You know, it's in the $8 to $12 range, so the price is right. Third-party validation with gold medals out of state, and it's locally made. So you tell us what's going on there. The Indiana wine industry is a little frustrated right now with that aspect.
We're so legit. We're so legit. It's all it's from here, and we're making it right here. So we just kind of have to move on and take care of the people that do want to embrace us and hear about what really local means. It's kind of my challenge, is what does local mean to you?
We have four vineyards within 300 miles of where we're standing that we grow 97-98% of everything we make in those four vineyards. I don't see how much more local it could get.
See the grapes get processed. We do. We get people who pop their chairs up out here when they see on Facebook that it's crush time. They'll just pack their lunch and they'll come out here and they'll watch. We think it's great.
Well, that is great. Now, that's a very cool thing, because you're bringing the grapes in that you've grown and you're going to turn them into wine right here in downtown Indianapolis.
Yep, right.
And there's 30 plus people working here making that wine for them right here in our local community. Each of our farms has anywhere from 2 to 6 people working in it throughout the year, depending on the time of pruning and harvest and all that. So it's supporting local jobs. I mean, it has so many feel-good points to it. It's interesting as to why you don't find local wines on local restaurant wine lists.
We've been talking with Mark and Meredith Easley of Easley Winery in Indianapolis. Stay with us for more about the downtown winery here on WFYI and WFYI.org. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Eskenazi Health. With its 315-bed hospital and inpatient facilities and 11 community health centers located throughout Indianapolis, eskenazihealth.edu. Well, when it comes to choosing wines, especially local wines, the awards and medals won in competitions can certainly help guide your choices, but nothing beats actually tasting. Easley Winery in downtown Indianapolis is open daily for tasting, and on Saturday afternoons hosts its popular Groovin' in the Garden event. So Meredith Easley walked us through what winery visitors can expect.
We didn't win right out of the gate. I mean, like Mark said, we definitely have adopted better equipment, better wine practices, and that's been an evolution. So we may have been around for 41 years, but we've only hit our vineyard stride the first 30 years, and now we're hitting our winemaking stride. So we're really glad that, we do enter competitions and we do win, because it does give that benchmark and that barometer. And it gives then our distributors something to talk about when they're, trying to sell a wine that maybe they don't have time to describe and to get into the nuances of. And everybody understands you win or you lose. So it's an easy measure. But it's only the tip of our marketing iceberg.
Tell me what the customer experiences when they first walk in.
It's our three E's of Easley. So first, we embrace you, which means we welcome you, we let you know that we're glad you're here, and then we educate you on what it is you're sampling and trying, or if you want to learn about home wine and beer making, our idea is to educate. And then the third E is to encourage you to buy, because that's what allows us to continue to be here.
So you're open. People can come in and taste during the week,
of course,
right?
Yep, 7 days a week. So we're open Monday through Friday, 11 to 6, Saturdays, 9 to 6, and Sundays, 12 to 4. You can buy wine at Indiana wineries on Sundays, and that's true across the whole state.
So tell me a little bit about the weekends and the wine garden and the party atmosphere that you have here.
Sure. Well, the Monday through Friday atmosphere is definitely, we get a lot of the non-traditional workforce. We had a group in probably 2 weeks ago, and it was a group of servers that are downtown, and every Tuesday they take off together and they go do something else downtown. So they popped in to see us, and they don't even work at the same restaurant. So that's that non-traditional workforce where they're working late, but their afternoons are available. Retirees, it's much slower pace. We'll see just a handful of visitors every day, Monday through Thursday, a few more on Fridays. And then when Saturdays hit, it is a party. So come with your party hat on, your dancing shoes, because especially May through September, when we have Groovin' in the Garden on Saturdays from 2 to 5, we've had to get to the point where we have to ask people to bring their own chairs. Because we have chairs for, 100 plus people, but, they go so quickly. And so people do pack their own picnics. They bring their chairs. They bring their own little tables. They bring their own decor. They have their class reunions here, parties.
That's kind of fun. So they have, they set up their whole little area, right?
Yeah, they do. We had one group, and it was literally a class reunion, and they had their center table, and everybody brought their pitch-in item on this little coffee table thing that looked straight off of their back porch, and they were kicking back with all their soccer chairs and having a great time, and we're completely flattered that they decided to spend that time here with us. So.
Now, do they come in, and are they tasting then? Are they just buying wine and drinking it in the wine garden area, or what?
All of the above. So you definitely... if they're repeat customers, they're popping in, they're saying hi to Jerry, who's in the wine garden, has run the wine garden for us for about 7 years. Hey, Jerry, what's on special? Jerry tells them what's on special, and then they head straight to the cooler. They know what they want. They hop in line, show their ID, pay for it. And the visitors that are first-timers or folks that are bringing friends that are visiting from out of town, or if it's a date, you can always tell, when they're just kind of getting to know each other, kind of go easy on those folks. We're not too rambunctious. And then it's $5 to taste 7 wines. They step inside the front door, turn to their left, and it's $5. You're given an unpunched champagne cork. So not many people have those. Most people have the champagne corks after they've been in the bottle. So then they come into the arbor room. They're greeted by their wine steward. They're given a wine list, kind of coached on what they're about to experience for the next 45 minutes. The wine steward takes them on a brief tour of the winery that leads them to their tasting bar. IDs are checked. Champagne cork is collected. And then the fun begins because you're given a glass. So, yep. And then we just walk you through about 7 different wines. And if there's a special occasion or anything like that, we always try to embarrass the guest of honor, or at least call them out. So, yep, it's just definitely a party, and then people get wine and cheese. We do carry local Swissland cheeses from up north. We joke they're Amish cows, they're clean living cows, and they just go outside and sit and have a great time. Or if they're bachelorettes, they hop in their limo and go to Flat 12. Yeah, wherever they're headed next.
Tell me just a little bit about some of the wines that people can expect when they're in here, and some of the ones that are winning awards.
Sure. Monday through Friday, we do make 24 different wines, and you can sample from our entire wine list. So you get to guide from, and we always recommend start dry and work your way sweeter. And within any of those given categories, you move from dry, you go from dry to sweet, and from whites to reds. So it's because of what happens with the layering of your palate. We do provide crackers and things like that and water just to help keep your palate cleansed as possible. So that's really that Monday through Friday experience. Huge selection. On Saturday, we refine it, and you get to choose between 2 different wines at each barrel, and you get to sample from 7 different barrels, as we call it. So you're going to get to experience our 2013 Cabernet Sauvignon, which took the gold medal in Monterey, California this year. It's absolutely delightful, fruit-forward in comparison to our 2011 Cabernet, which has definitely mellowed out quite a bit. And it's more in keeping probably with that traditional French style of winemaking, where it's very balanced, very layered, not particularly fruit forward, but just very, very dry, solid, great to have with a meal. Whereas I find myself just happy to sip on that Cabernet 2013. But it's a little bit fruitier. It's bone dry, but because it is a 2013 vintage, it still has a lot of its fruitiness to it, which is just so easy to drink. And then you're going to move into things like our Chardonnay. I think Mark mentioned we use a different yeast on it that allowed us to pull a lot more of some of the nuances of the fruit through naturally, through that colder fermentation. when we were playing with it, we noted that it kind of had some citrus come forward that I'd never experienced in a Chardonnay before. And I found that really, really delightful. That's actually what I had last night with my tilapia. So, and I took a glass over to the neighbor. So I'm like, Steph, have some Chardonnay. So, yeah, anything from those you're going to experience on the weekend to, of course, our award-winning Traminette. It's absolutely a lovely, unique, you know, I hesitate to say that it's floral, but that seems to be a word that's attached to it. So when I try to give it a specific, I really think it almost has more of like a white grapefruit quality to it. Kind of living between that Sauvignon Blanc, Pinot Grigio, but because it has just that hint of sweetness to it, almost a little bit of that Riesling minerality. So, you know, it really is a unique taste profile. That's why I think it won, because it's exceptional for its varietal, but it also is this newer varietal that people aren't as familiar with, and so it stands out, and it's just absolutely delightful. Of course, we have to sample out our Sweet Tulip Moscato and Pink Moscato. That varietal is so popular.
Those are very popular, aren't they? They're just sipping wines.
Sipping,
right?
And just so easy to drink. You know, kind of peachy, apricotty, just really, you know, and a little bit lighter or brighter than, say, like a Riesling because of that, you know, it's a little bit crisper with our Moscato. Our Riesling is absolutely amazing and is grown in southern Michigan, which I think is the emerging Riesling growing. I think it's going to, you know, we always had Germany on the radar. The Finger Lakes have done an amazing job with their Riesling, but the conditions in Michigan, watch out. It's just really fantastic. And then when you move into the Reyes, I say it's the sweetest, fruitiest, happiest wine you will ever meet.
Okay, now that is one of the very, 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 very popular wines, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's so easy to drink. And plus, we have a lot of cocktail recipes that go with it because it is this party, fun wine. The label tells you, hey, you're going to get up and dance. If you have a glass of this, you're expected to. So, yeah, Mark says, oh, get your limbo on. You know, yeah, exactly. It is a little bit lower alcohol, so you can drink a whole bottle and be okay. So we hear on voicemail at 2 a.m. Yeah, those are the best calls. We get these calls. The best one was from this German lady, which totally surprised me because Germans, you know, typically drink drier. And she's like, this reggae is fabulous.
We've been talking with Meredith Easley of Easley Winery in downtown Indianapolis. For more information on the winery and its award-winning wines, go to easleywinery.com. You've been listening to Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio here on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. Thanks so much for tuning in to Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio this week. And thanks also to our guests, Tom England, Executive Director of Dig In, A Taste of Indiana. The festival is happening this weekend in White River State Park. And thanks also to Mark and Meredith Easley of Easley Winery in downtown Indianapolis. And thanks also to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio.